this, the topic. It really spans everything in through physics and astrophysics. And my own expertise as far as this topic goes has been using effective field theory to connect the parameters of the standard model to the real world. And in this case, the issue is the connecting of the light quark masses to nuclear binding, which is a piece of this larger puzzle. I got interested in it as a at a time when I was trying to do something on the equivalence principle with Thibaut Damour, who collaborator in some portion of this. And at the time, I felt that I'd probably end up doing something that, let's call it artistic. You make some inspired guess and you do something that seems to you to be reasonable. And I learned as I went through there that some of the advances, both on the nuclear side and the particle physics side, allowed me to do actually a pretty reasonable job. And so, in fact, it turned out to be a much better connection that felt I could do than I had any belief going into it that I could do. And so I'm relatively happy with the outcome of the work. So that's what I'll be talking about how quark masses influence nuclear binding, and then a little bit on how these lead to constraints that may or may not be interesting for other things. Before I do that, I'm going to start off with three slides on a completely off topic, but it's along the topic of the, at least it's off my main topic here, but it's on topic for the conference. It's basically some limits on spatial variations of the cosmological constant of dark energy from the CMB. And I'll just do this in just the broadest strokes. You can look it up if you want, but it's just an advertisement rather than a detailed talk. So, and after that, I'll come, after that sort of amuse-bouche that I'll start off with, I'll come back to the main course and go into nuclear binding. Okay? So let's first do this completely off-topic stuff. I got interested in this thinking about variable parameters because in the CMB there is some indication in the low partial waves, the low L values, for an asymmetry. And basically it was done by Erickson, Hans, and Gorsky looking at different patches in the sky and doing a multiple analysis of the CMB power spectrum and noting that there is an asymmetry. Okay, so there's the little patches they did. You look and you find an asymmetry, you sort of break the world up into two hemispheres. It runs roughly along a line that goes along like that. And you look at the northern part and the southern part, and you see different power spectrum. So here's the main CMB, and here's the hemispheric pattern. So this is the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere. You see more power in one hemisphere than the other. And that, since the cosmological constant influences this portion of the CMB power spectrum through the late time integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, you'd think maybe there would be a limit on the cosmological constant, or maybe other parameters. Or it might be an indication of a variable dark energy, spatially varying dark energy. And the answer is no. And the reason the answer is no is that further up this power spectrum, there's that first acoustic peak, which most of you have seen, and that does not show the asymmetry. So here's the Hans, the let's see, Hansen, Bonde, Gorsky had the data for the location and the height of the first acoustic peak in all those little patches that they had over there. And there it is. It's not, you can't label which one it is, but you of course know it. And you ask, is there any systematic asymmetry? If there was a change in cosmological constant from that part of the universe to the other part, it'd be manifest by shifting back and forth this way. If some of the other, the amplitude or spectral tilt would be in slightly different directions. So the answer is that there is no directional dependence of any of that. If you look, there's no real direction at all. It's just consistent with cosmic variance. And so you can put limits on the spatial variation of the cosmological constant over the largest lever arm possible from one surface of last scattering to the other surface on the other side of the universe. So,
effects without introducing a connected term for
the gradient is extremely small to get across here. So there's essentially no gradient energy. These two portions of the universe are out of causal contact. So this is the phenomenon. You're seeing nothing, so you're seeing essentially no gradient. So there's no gradient energy. So it's useful. So you'd have to look elsewhere for that. But in this idea of limiting spatial and temporal variations of parameters, that's the piece. So that's the advertisement.
So yeah, what is the fractional variation of numbers?
So this is this number right here.
Just percent.
Yes, that's delta lambda over lambda.
It's delta lambda over lambda. Okay.
Delta lambda over lambda. Okay. And that's, for what it's worth, that's that piece of phenomenology. Now, completely shift gears. What I'd like to do is take you through a calculation of nuclear binding and their quark mass dependence. And my strategy here is to isolate the most sensitive piece, two quark masses, and do as good a job as I can on that. And there'll be some small corrections, which I won't even make much of an effort on. But those go into the error bars. Okay. So along the way, I've answered, to my own satisfaction, some of the questions I've always had about nuclear physics. So I'll tell you how that works also. So here's a cartoon from a textbook, nuclear textbook, on nuclear binding, showing what are the main features are. The main features are a 1-pion exchange, the longest distance, an intermediate range attractive potential, which is often modeled by scalar exchange, and a short distance repulsive interaction, which is often modeled by a vector meson exchange. In heavy nuclei, which is where I'm going to work, the 1-pion piece is not that relevant. Basically, the spin and isospin flip that's associated with pion exchange makes that subdominant compared to the scalar pieces, which these are both scalar pieces. So it's mainly those two pieces. And one of the advances that makes this more understandable now is also noting that you don't actually have to know the complete details of these potentials. You don't have to know that exact shape. It's not that crucial. Because at very low energies, and this is quite low energies, 10 MeV for a nucleon, the effect of any Yukawa-like potential is like a delta function. Or even if it wasn't Yukawa-like, any short-range potential is essentially a delta function potential when treated with long, very low-energy probes. And so, in fact, it's much easier to use the delta function with an arbitrary coefficient here. It's not necessarily that one, just some arbitrary coefficient, instead of a potential. It reduces a functional dependence and a strength to one number, which is just the strength. And remarkably, it works very well. Here's a bunch of serious nuclear physicists who have gone down this pathway. So this isn't my work, this is theirs. And basically, you parameterize the Hamiltonian for the nuclear physics in terms of scalar densities, tensor densities, spin flips, to various powers. So there's the density squares, there's density cubes, there's gradients of densities, et cetera. But these are all just contact interactions, point-like interactions. But then there's a number of parameters here, and just those parameters to do your physics. But it's better than trying to do shapes of potentials and strengths of potentials. It's more simple. And here's
psi are nucleons itself?
Yes, psi are nucleons. So basically, this is psi bar psi squared is a two nucleon interaction. CyberSci cubed is a three nanometer machine.
And they do equally well as conventional nuclear physics models. So here's these tables. It's just, you know, it's not that important. But PC is this point coupling or contact interaction models. They do as well as conventional nuclear physics models for heavy nuclei. So it's actually a relatively robust technique. Moreover, there was a very nice paper that tells us what are the most important of these. And this is a busy plot. It takes a while to understand, but let me just tell you what the answers are. If you go back to this parameterization here, you can have density squares, density cubes, density floors, gradients, et cetera. And this is a listing of all those terms and which ones are important numerically. How important are they? High means they're important. Low means they're unimportant. Okay, and here's typical 8 MeV per nucleon binding energy. So the really the important ones are two of them. There's a scalar and a vector ones. These are the ones up here, the scalar and vector ones, that determine everything. Everything else is subdominant. You know, here's a three nucleon interaction. There's some gradient interactions down here. But all these things are subdominant compared to the two big ones. So I'll take a look at the two big ones. And these do correspond to exactly what was in that cartoon to begin with, the scalar attraction, the vector repulsion. But now it's quantified in just two simple numbers. So what we have now is we've quantified the most part of nuclear physics in those two numbers, plus some residual contributions, which I'm going to put in an error box. So if you ask how does the binding energy per nucleon vary, these guys have told us that it's dominantly the scalar one. Here's the ratio. If I'm going to vary these guys, I'll vary nuclear binding by the scalar piece, the vector piece, some residual stuff, and some kinetic energy. That's the recipe. So we'll look at these. Now, in practice, I've done a careful job on the vector piece. I'm not even going to tell you about it because its effect is quite small. So I'm not going to waste time on it. All the action happens in the scalar piece. So I want to understand that because that's the attractive part of nuclear binding. Okay, so my goal is to construct these now. I'm trying to get them from QCD. What does this contact interaction mean? It basically gives you a constant piece in the scattering amplitude. The next order term, if you expanded the scattering amplitude in powers of Q squared, the next order piece corresponds to derivative interactions. So it's those gradient interactions that were very small in that plot. It's the constant piece that's the important piece. So then all I have to do is I have to understand the scattering process, and that's getting now closer to what I know how to do. Moreover, there's a nice piece of old technology that makes it even easier for me. This is dispersion relation techniques, which tell you that to understand the scattering amplitude, all I have to know is the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude. So the on-shell part of the scattering amplitude. And that's something that's even easier to calculate. So if I get that, piece, so you'll see it called rho in the following features. It's the imaginary part of the scattering amplitude. I can construct these analytically and take their imaginary parts. If I get that, I just do an integral over that from threshold to technically infinity to get this constant. And what you can hold in the background as a reference value is if I had a narrow resonance, it appears as a delta function in this spectral function. So just be a spike. And we won't find that, but that's the reference value. That gives you then can give you a potential, but it certainly gives you these constants just by doing that integral. Okay, and here's roughly the answer. So the people who did this technology in the old days went out, looked at scattering data, tried
doing fits to scattering data to get these spectral functions. And then they would then take these and use them in nuclear physics by making potentials out of them. I'm going to use this slightly differently. But here's the answer. It's basically in this channel, the scalar channel, the spectral functions starts off, well, this is going to be, it's going to be two pions, goes up, peaks, and turns over. And that's really the origin of this sigma exchange in nuclear physics. It's really a 2-pi exchange. And this, to some extent, even though there's no error bars, it's a cartoon version of what is needed to fit scattering data. So my goal is to do something similar, but get analytic control over that so that I can then vary masses. Okay. Well, that's the type of calculation that I, in fact, used to doing. Here's a sample one just so you can see how it's done in other cases. Gamma to 2 pi's. This is going to be also 2 pi intermediate state. This is particularly nice because there's no chiral coefficients here. This is an effective field theory technique, which is called chiral perturbation theory. Chiral perturbation theory is a use of the symmetries of QCD plus experiment to measure unknown constants that yield dynamical predictions. And here you do a polynomial which is predicted by the theory times a rescattering matrix, because this is rescattering of charged pions and neutral pions in the so-called omnis function that involves the pi-pi phase shifts. And this matching here is something that I've done a lot of times in the past. And here's roughly how it ends up working. If you didn't do the omnis function, you just get this straight line here. You add that, it gives you actually a very nice agreement. This is a very close analogy to the calculation I'm about to do. You can match this to one loop and two loop chiral perturbation theory. And since I know your backgrounds are all different, I'm not going to go into too much detail with this. But this is the game that people do in chiral perturbation theory do routinely. So now if we do this with nucleons, we have various couplings of pions and nucleons, which are known. This piece is the usual pion coupling. Here's a 2-pion coupling. And these constants here, so the energy dependence of this is measured by going off and doing pi nucleon scattering, so something completely different, only one nucleon around. So this is measured somewhere else. So in this sense, there's very little free parameters. This one does have a bit of a range, but that's an experimental range.
People call the sigma.
That's a sigma. Yeah.
And its sort of experimental value keeps fluctuating.
Yeah, but that would
be 47 MeV, right?
Yeah.
Are there any prospects of getting it once and for all, or say from the lattice or anything like that?
It enters many places. It's subdominant here, very small here, because it comes with the pion mass. These other things come with the energy. Okay? And so the energy quickly overwhelms the pion mass. And so it's really not a big player.
You're saying that the derivative terms are UV saturated.
Yes, they get bigger and UV quicker. Otherwise, they just have a constant amplitude. Okay?
So the diagrams that are around here have been known and explored, and you take the cut here. You don't actually have to do the loop in order. You're just taking a cut, and you get the imaginary parts, and here they are. But we tackle on this omnis function, which involves pi-pi phase shifts. We know we've learned how to match this order by order to chiral perturbation theory, blah, 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 blah. This is the technology that I'm hiding from, okay? Here's the result. The result of just turning the crank in chiral perturbation theory gives you a spectral function, which, you know, this is the negative of the spectral function, so they're the same thing, really, that has exactly the right properties. It also has about the right magnitude. It's a little bit big, and I can imagine higher order corrections that bring it down, but it's a little bit big, but it's roughly in the right magnitude and size. People who are not used to chiral perturbation theory need a little orientation here that this is a rigorous technique, but it's expansion in the energy, generally the energy over 1 GeV. So the technique falls apart completely out here. So that, you know, if you're down this end here, you feel it's really rigorous. As you get up around, you know, here it's a bit model dependent, because there are higher order terms that I've not included in that region, and then it goes completely way out there. But since our main region of interest is going to be down at low energies, it's not bad there. Okay, and moreover, this thing gives you exactly the sigma. This is R times V of R. If I just Fourier transform this vector function, I get a potential. There's actually two curves on here. You can see them a little bit right here. They're a little separated right there. But it basically looks just like a narrow sigma, despite the fact that it isn't. So it would really confuse you if you didn't know that. So we really reproduced the sigma without having a fundamental sigma there. So the sigma, the modern picture of the sigma is that you have these scattering amplitudes along the real axis. If you analytically continue them way off the real axis, you do get a pole somewhere out there. You know, it seems this is the best recent work. You know, its width is bigger than its mass. But the point is that the sigma is a secondary effect to the scattering amplitude. The scattering amplitude can be driven by usual chiral perturbation theory. It implies a sigma, but nevertheless, it's not determined by this. Okay, so I overall feel this is a much more understandable picture. We have just a few constants to do, and we've actually got reasonable control over that, those parameters, over those constants. So now, let's try this issue of varying the quark mass and seeing how it varies. The answer is going to be what's in this picture here. Almost all of the difference is kinematic. As you vary the quark mass, the spectral function, if m equals to 0 is there, the physical one is there, and there's a higher mass one. So if you change the spectral function, or you change the pion mass or change the quark mass, the main effect is just changing the thresholds. So there's two ways I could do that. If I was trying to be pure chiral perturbation theory, I throw away the part out there that's somewhat model dependent, and just look at the low energy region. If I'm being a bit more ambitious, I can take the treatment all the way through there, including all known mass effects, to see if out here there's any effect. In the end, I don't find much effect out at high energies. And so it's really all the threshold effects and the uncertainties of, you'll see error bars in the end, amount to the effects that I don't know how well I'm controlling at the highest energies.
So the equivalent to variation over in some units of the pion mass.
Exactly. So I should say that for the non-experts. The pion mass squared is the quark mass times the constant.
So if you had a loop of some kind that was UV convergent, UV divergent, right? And if you differentiate, you may get the chiral log, right? I mean,
there are chiral logs in this thing. There are chiral logs. But they come from the low energy part. Any non-analytic stuff has to come from low energy, doesn't come from high energy. Okay. So let's quickly do this. So the spectral functions themselves, we have the quark mass dependence through the pion mass through this relationship. That's pretty straightforward there. The scattering lengths, in the previous one, I used experimental numbers from Colangelo, Gasser, and Neufeiler. I need analytic controls over that. We know that at low energies, at high energies, our analytic control falls off a bit. So the best that I can do is this inverse amplitude method, which I described. And you can see, there's the data, here's this method. It's good at low energies and falls off at low high energies, so I don't have complete control over that at the highest energies. But the omnis functions that come out look pretty similar. The basic effects even here are going to be kinematic. These things are going to just have different thresholds. The threshold in these functions starts where the official kinematic threshold is. And then there's implicit dependence on the parameters, like the pion decay constant. That one's under great control. In G sub A, it's not under great control. There's some unknown pion mass dependence there, which in fact in the end is quite a big uncertainty. Okay, here's the size of that uncertainty. It's really quite relatively large. That goes into the error bars. In fact, it's a big contribution to the error budget. And then there's the answer. So basically, I put all those pieces together, turn the crank, and you see that there's a significant effect in the integral. But it comes mainly from the place where I have control. Here's the big strength of the scalar interaction, how it shifts. It shifts by 12% or 10%, depending on whether I go one way or the other. It's not a perfectly linear function. Here's the function. It has a little curvature to it, but it's almost linear. The error bar in this guy is just from G sub A, which is by far the dominant interaction. I'll include some other error bars later on. We then take a look at the overall binding energy, and the binding energy then depends heavily on the pion mass also. And particularly, here's the picture of it. It actually very quickly, it has quite a significant slope, partially due to the fact that this effect was big, where there was a cancellation going on, and partially due to this is a relatively large dependence on the pion mass. Physical, M physical. So the physical mass, so this is the one that varies, and the pH is the one that stays constant. Okay. I should say that Thibault produced a very nice nuclear matter calculation in a slightly different model, a Velechka model, that tells us why those coefficients are big and why other ones are small. It also has some rho cube piece, and so it has some subdominant couplings. But it really enhances our understanding here. So that's my main result. I'll use it in a minute. I only have a few minutes left anyhow. Any questions about that at this stage? Yeah.
Zero pion mass.
I see. And you say then the binding energy per nucleon would be 40.
If it goes down pretty deep.
To minus 40 MeV.
Minus 38 is.
Yeah, and physically it's about minus 10.
Minus 10. About, yeah, it's a big change.
Yeah.
It's actually, I find that interesting. It's basically because you get a lot more attracted to pi in that case. Okay, just a brief comment on strange quark dependence. If we're trying to do the same thing for the strange quark, we'd be using kaons in the loops, and this threshold would start way up at a GeV. And so I have no sense that kaons contribute in any way to this. There's, of course, a large literature on strange quark dependence of hadron properties, which may be just a shift in lambda QCD. But I have no indication from what I've done here that there's any strange quark dependence in this part of nuclear binding. Okay? So people who want to talk about that can do that. So now let's use it. One of the first things you notice about this is that binding goes to zero relatively quickly. So this is interesting for another portion of physics, which is these anthropic constraints. Yep.
fun.
What's your favorite sort of estimate for S bar S over the nuclear state?
I'd probably give it 100, but I'm not sure that that's something that if you very 100 MeV. This is probably my favorite at this stage of the game. But I would not be surprised if that was not a sort of a universal shift from MeTCD rather than because there's actually very little evidence for strange quarks dynamically active in nucleons. And so you're probably one who'd like to talk about this. But that's my take on that after many years of waffling back and forth. Okay, so let's just do some fun things, but your interest in this may be high or low. I'm just going to do it. The first is going to be anthropic constraints. If you can understand how the standard model reaches of the world, you should be able to understand variations in the immediate neighborhood of where we are. So we've seen the changing quark masses can eliminate nuclear binding. If we go up, not too far up, basically a couple sigma, we can't go more than 64% higher than the physical values of the masses. The heavy nuclei would fall apart. It's also from indications of deuteron and probably everything in between too. This is commonly from the heavy atoms here. But so the nuclei fall apart, so we don't have atoms. Then there's a second anthropic constraint that if the neutron proton mass splitting again becomes too big, we don't want neutrons to completely decay and leave only protons and electrons around, because then you'd end up with a hydrogen world only. Leads to a second constraint. And the interesting feature I find is not the exact numbers, but that these are very relatively tight constraints, very close to where we are. Here's the region that's allowed by these two constraints. But if you put that on the scale of lambda QCD, so this is in units of MeV. Here, out here is 200 MeV, which is roughly lambda QCD. Which is not a big number at all, but it's just that tiny little window down there is anthropically allowed. Okay, so it's a curiosity if nothing else. Let's very quickly just do this Oakwell constraint. The Oakwell constraint is in a paper with Kibo that's virtual, and I'm going to do a very bad job on it just because we had agreed on some procedure for getting this out, and as Thibault's writing it up, he says, "No, I believe that's all wrong, but I have the solution." Unfortunately, I haven't seen the solution yet, so I'm just doing the most simple thing, which is that the Oakwell constraint. We'll have a talk about that tomorrow. I'm using it as a null result at the moment, though we may hear differently. But basically, there's the Oakwell reactor has, by looking at the abundance of samarium, has a constraint on the reaction rate for this reaction dating back to the time that the Oakwell went off, which I think I have on the next slide. Oh, it's roughly there, roughly 2 billion years. It proceeds through a very low-lying resonance, and because that resonance enhances the sensitivity, you can if you shift that resonance, you turn off this reaction. And let me just very roughly estimate that the shift in that energy goes like the single particle binding energy in samarium. If I use this parameter 80 equals to 1, it's actually a result of Flambaum and Cyriac. I'm using it just a little conservatively. 8 is a half, allows for some shift in the samarium, in the resonance energy also. In any case, if you do that, you get a relatively tight constraint on the variation of the quark mass over this period of time. This is really just the one particle expectation value of the nuclear potential. So it's one particle in a nuclear potential, so the last nucleon. That's just seeing how it shifts its energy. Okay, that's really all it is. As I said, it's very crude. We'll do something more fancy in the paper, but I can't say what it is yet. The other thing, which is actually my original interest, and it'll be the last thing I'll just mention, is the equivalence principle tests. The idea is that couplings of the dilaton to psi bar psi, or any light scalar to psi bar psi, is very, very much like the quark mass term m psi bar psi. So if you want to know how this light scalar couples to anything, you need to know how the mass, quark mass dependence. And so in particular, in the equivalence principle test, one of the weakest things that we know many things about how masses and affect nucleon masses, how alpha affects the nucleon, how they influence equivalence principle tests. The weakest of our understanding is how quark masses and couple the binding energy, or how the scalar would couple the binding energy. And if you're comparing two different elements, there's a lot of energy in the binding energy.
Universal coupled to all quarks, right? Yeah. You need to take it's a little bit like a Higgs coupling to right. It's driven not by light quarks, but mostly by binary quarks.
If you put an extra factor of m in, that'd be true.
That's right.
But it's not necessarily true. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, you'll see, just wait a minute, then you won't argue with me too much. Okay. So if you have some general coupling here, like the mass term, we want to understand how that coupling goes. And this is just formalism. So what's missing is just we know how the atomic masses depend on quark masses on E&M. We know how electron binding goes. We don't know this guy. So that's the last piece. And the part I didn't show you earlier was how I know the A dependence of this is just an application of the semi-empirical mass formula combined with actual constraints from real nuclear physics calculations. Anyhow, let's just leave that aside. The answer, and the reason you're not going to give me a hard time, is that the differences turn out to be unimportant. It's basically the fact that the strongest contribution to the binding energy is isoscalar. It's basically the same per nucleon as you go across the periodic tables. It doesn't vary a whole lot. The other effects, the charge asymmetry and the neutron-proton asymmetry, are much bigger. So it's not a big difference, a big effect in the equivalence principle test. Again, this is coming out in our paper, but the answer is basically no. So here's my summary. I've argued that we have reasonable control over the key ingredients in nuclear physics, that the quark mass dependence, the dominant quark mass dependence, comes from the region where we think we have good control, and that we understand it reasonably well, and that there's now a host of applications. There can be applications to all the standard variational constants tests. Okay. Thank you.
I have a question about your advertisement.
Yes.
Okay. Where taking your result, whoever's result was for the variation of lambda in space, does that actually have any implication about the variation in time of these constants? Because I think if you're sort of naive, and I realize that logic is wrong, spatial variations are connected to time variations on the basis of special relativity, and I'm aware that special relativity may not be the relevant issue, but you would get some conclusion in this faulty way on that variation.
I think one way of saying what you're saying is that if they vary in space or time, they're a field, and so they can then vary in either. So I think there is no formal way to make a connection, because you could have a field in inflation become absolutely uniform in space. So if you go through many e-foldings in inflation, your field will be absolutely uniform, or almost, you know, essentially uniform. It can still be time varying. So inflation has this feature of making it uniform. So you can't say that this limit, that it's uniform from one side of the universe to the other, implies that it's not time varying. It could still be.
Could you just go back to the result for the semi-empirical mass formula?
Yeah, sure. I have a formal result way back.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, there it is.
Is this B?
Finding an energy for nucleon as a function of A.
Sure. And then you plug in this dependence of eta S.
Right, and then you plug in that, and then here it is in general.
Yeah, well, according to what I was just going to explain, this difference between the A and the A to the two thirds,
yeah,
gives you some quite significant result. But okay, that will be my talk.
All right. I mean, there is certainly a dependence on this as you go across the periodic table. It seems subdominant to the other effects.
Which I'd like to ask some sort of peripheral question.
Okay.
The electromagnetic mass difference of hydrogen and proton,
right,
their mass difference due to the up and down force,
right,
they're being estimated to kind of the electromagnetic one back in the 60s, am I right?
Yeah, I think Gabriel had one of them.
All right, I mean, are there any desire in the sort of to improve that using the modern techniques like lattice? I mean, I'm confused why it's not done, because it enters in many ways, in a very significant way.
Yeah. I mean, in the lattice, it's actually a significant change in their methodology. They have to have E and M to reduce the D calculation. I don't know of any solid way to improve that in our present framework. You know, I spent a good deal of time doing an improvement of pi on K on electromagnetic mass differences, using these chiral techniques to the best of my ability. And I think that got improved relatively well. But given what we were doing there, I don't see how I could do much better in nucleons than what was done already.
But why these people should try to do that?
Someone wiser than me. Yeah, no, I understand. I actually think that in the nucleons it's relatively under control. I don't see the estimates being too terrible. But we always would love better control.
Any other questions? So I have a question.
Exactly.
Or comment, I don't know, maybe. You assume that sigma has no strange content at all. Yes?
My sigma is built out of finite sets.
The point is that according to what I thought, basically, in pseudo-scalar channel, S3 grid goes up, highest state, and scalar channel, S3 grid goes down, lowest state. So there is a physical sigma consisting of containing S quad because it's S3 scalar. And it must be a lower state in this channel. So even if you start from pi pi, even if you start from pure pi pi, there will be mixing with this SU3 single signal.
SU3 is so badly broken in this channel. I don't think that has any real significance. That classification. Now there are these states around 1 GeV, which look very much like KV bar states. Those are probably where the escort resides. I think there's no evidence at all that the sigma contains short shorts.
Any other questions? So we now have coffee break.